Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com. This is anti-war news for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. Right, so I just want to start off again today reminding everybody that we have started our fundraiser at antiwar.com, and this is how we get by. We are reliant on our readers for donations. We're trying to raise 100 grand for this fundraiser cycle, which is a little more than usual. In recent years, we've been shooting for 80,000, but costs have gone up. We also haven't done a fundraiser in a while. If you want to support us, go to antiwar.com/donate, see the different ways that you can help out. And, you know, it goes without saying that we have been really busy lately. I mean, my head has been kind of spinning with all the news I've been trying to cover lately. You know, we do a lot with a small budget. And, you know, we crank out a lot of content every day. And we're never going to put anything behind a paywall. We want to make it available to everybody. But because of that, we need to do these fundraisers. So again, antiwar.com/donate to see the different ways you could help out. Credit card donation, PayPal, crypto. A lot of people support us with crypto. That's always nice. So antiwar.com/donate. All right, let's get into the news here. The U.S. is planning a major weapons package for Ukraine. U.S. officials told Politico that the Biden administration is preparing a larger than normal weapons package for Ukraine that will include armored vehicles and arms to support Ukraine's artillery and air defense capabilities. The package is expected to include Bradley fighting vehicles, Humvees, M113 armored personnel carriers, and missiles. The Pentagon wants the military equipment to be ready to go once President Biden signs a bill into law authorizing $61 billion in spending for the proxy war. The House passed the new Ukraine aid over the weekend, along with the bills for Israel and Taiwan, and that's going to be all rolled together into one piece of legislation, and the House is expected to vote on this on Tuesday. And of course, Biden is very supportive of this legislation and says that he's going to sign it right away. And he actually spoke with Zelensky on Monday and said that he would sign the bill once it reaches his desk. The White House said in a readout of the call, quote, "President Biden shared that his administration will quickly provide significant new security assistance packages to meet Ukraine's urgent battlefield and air defense needs as soon as the Senate passes the National Security Supplemental and he signs it into law," end quote. So officials said that the first arms package using this new $61 billion will be significantly larger than the most recent weapons package that the U.S. gave to Ukraine, which was worth $300 million. So a few times during this war, the U.S. announced arms packages for Ukraine worth $1 billion or more. So that's how big these things have been. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see something like that. And this is, you know, it's been 6 months since Biden requested this spending from Congress. So I think they're going to try to make a big show of this to say, see, look, we're still in this thing. And you know, I wouldn't even be surprised if they get into the $2 billion range with this thing. And another thing, so Zelensky said on Monday night, and this is included in this new bill, it stipulates that Ukraine will receive Army tactical missile systems, the ATACMS. And these are missiles that can be fired from the HIMARS rocket launchers that have a range of about 190 miles. The U.S. has secretly armed Ukraine with an older variant of the ATACMS, and these ones are actually cluster bomb versions, which is a whole nother thing to get into. I mean, cluster bombs are notorious for killing and maiming civilians. It's why they're banned by over 100 countries, but the U.S. Has been dumping them into Ukraine. So that older variant has a range of 100 miles. The newer one, again, has a range close to 200 miles. So that would be a big escalation in U.S. support for Ukraine. That's a longer distance than anything that they've given Ukraine up to this point. So Zelensky saying that, he said this after he spoke with Biden, basically said that all the details are in place for Ukraine to get the attack them. So maybe we'll see that in the first arms package as well. This new aid for Ukraine, all this is going to ensure is that the war will continue, the fighting and dying and killing will continue. It's not expected to make much of a difference when it comes to Ukraine's prospects of having any kind of victory, as Zelensky defines it. They're still saying they're going to push the Russians out, but Russia is gaining all this territory. This might buy Ukraine more time, but they're also facing serious manpower shortages, and it's not really clear if their mobilization efforts are really going to make up for that. But this is going to get Biden through the election. I think that's all that they really care about at this point. And they do want to keep this. I mean, this is a total boondoggle for all the arms makers and everything. So, obviously they have their motivations to keep this thing going besides the election. And, this is something, Speaker Johnson basically put this stuff forward with the blessing of Trump. Trump just, again, on Monday said that, he's very happy with Mike Johnson. He calls him MAGA Mike Johnson. That's a sign that things, when it comes to Ukraine, might not change if Trump comes in. All right, so the next one here, Poland says that it's willing to host NATO nukes. This article is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute. The leader of Poland said that Warsaw was willing to host nuclear weapons from a NATO country in response to Russia moving strategic arms into Belarus. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk called the proposal absolutely massive, whatever he means by that. So this is the first time. So Poland has said this before, and this is the first time I've seen Tusk say it since he became prime minister. Polish President Andrzej Duda, who was the president in the last government too, he's also expressed his willingness to host NATO nuclear weapons. He said, quote, "I must admit that when asked about hosting nuclear weapons, I declared our readiness. Recently, Russia has been relocating its nuclear weapons to Belarus. If our allies decide to deploy nuclear weapons as part of nuclear sharing also on our territory to strengthen the security of NATO's eastern flank, we are ready for it," end quote. He went on to say that he expects some but not universal access to nuclear weapons if they're moved onto Polish territory. So, that's one thing that it's not really clear about NATO nuclear sharing, as far as I understand it, is the arrangement that the U.S. has. The nukes are controlled by the U.S. in the countries that it has them stationed in under the NATO nuclear sharing program. But at the same time, I know Germany maintains a fleet of bombers that are capable of dropping these nuclear bombs. So under NATO nuclear sharing, what is it? The U.S. has nukes in Germany, the Netherlands, Turkey. Now I'm blanking on the other two states, but these are, they haven't put nukes in, oh, here we go. Italy and Belgium are the other two. Kyle has it in his article. But moving it into Poland would be a huge escalation, of course, in the U.S. nuclear posture in Europe. They haven't put nukes in any NATO country that has joined since the end of the Cold War. All right. So the next one here, U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria come under attack. So U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria came under two separate rocket and drone attacks in less than 24 hours. And Reuters reported this on Monday, citing U.S. and Iraqi officials. The officials said that the attacks were the first since a nearly three-month pause started in February. So if you remember, the Iraqi government and Iran pressured the Iraqi Shia militias to stop targeting U.S. bases after three U.S. Army Reserve soldiers were killed at Tower 22 in Jordan, that base in Jordan that's like right on the Syrian border. Now, I know I was thinking when I first saw this story that there was other minor attacks, and I looked back, and the only one that I could find was when Israel bombed Iran's consulate in Damascus. I thought the U.S. bases came under attack after that, but looking back at the reports, the U.S. military said that it downed a drone, but the drone might have been headed toward Israel. So this seems to be the first, you know, significant attack on these U.S. bases, but no damage or casualties were reported. No sign of that this is going to cause a big escalation or anything. Although a Pentagon official later said that a fighter jet from the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq and Syria launched an airstrike against a rocket launcher, but did not specify where. So they're saying the U.S.-led coalition, that means it's either the U.S. or one of its allies. But, you know, this is something that could always, you know, escalate, I guess. And the attacks came after an explosion hit a base south of Baghdad that killed one member of the Popular Mobilization Forces, which is an umbrella group of Iraq's militias that's part of the Iraqi security forces. So that's the PMF, and the cause of that blast is unknown. I haven't seen any indication that they're blaming that blast on the U.S. So after these attacks first happened, there was reports that said a Telegram channel affiliated with Kateb Hezbollah, which is one of Iraq's most powerful Shia militias, reports said that a Telegram channel affiliated with them announced that attacks on U.S. forces have resumed because there was no progress toward a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. But later, Kateb Hezbollah denied issuing that statement, calling it fabricated news. But these attacks did happen after Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, if you remember, he visited Washington last week, and he was saying earlier this year that the U.S. has to go, but he hasn't made any progress in that direction. He's in these very long, what seem to be long, drawn-out talks with the U.S. about the issue, and both sides have left open the possibility of, even if they end the anti-ISIS coalition, the foreign anti-ISIS coalition, they kind of left open the possibility of U.S. troops staying in Iraq anyway. So I'm sure that they're not happy. These factions are not happy about that. I think there's a chance that these attacks could continue. And from mid-October, when they started in response to U.S. support for the Israeli slaughter in Gaza, you know, there's over nearly 200 drone and rocket attacks on U.S. bases between then and the Tower 22 one that ended up killing three U.S. troops. All right, so the next one here, Iran says that nuclear weapons have no place in its nuclear doctrine. So on Monday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry reaffirmed that Tehran is not seeking a nuclear bomb and that weapons have no place in Iran's nuclear doctrine. This is Iran's foreign ministry spokesman who said, quote, Iran has repeatedly said its nuclear program only serves peaceful purposes. Nuclear weapons have no place in our nuclear doctrine, end quote. So these comments came after an IRGC general suggested that Iran could change its nuclear doctrine if Israel attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. But any decision to build nuclear weapons would have to be made by Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And he issued a fatwa in 2003 forbidding the production and use of any weapons of mass destruction. And the Islamic Republic's first supreme leader, who was Ayatollah Khomeini, he also prohibited the creation of a WMD program. And I actually linked to a really interesting report there from Gareth Porter that he wrote for Foreign Policy back in 2014. And it's titled, When the Ayatollah Said No to Nukes. And he interviewed an IRGC or an Iranian military officer who was an officer during the Iran-Iraq war when Iraq was using chemical weapons in that war, being, you know, U.S.-backed chemical weapons attacks, I should say. The CIA knew that Saddam was going to use chemical weapons and shared intelligence with Iraq for these battles where he used it. And so there were some elements of the Iranian military who said, hey, why don't we start making chemical weapons, why don't we start a nuclear weapons program? And Khomeini, not Khamenei, the current leader, Khomeini said no, he forbid it. So both of them have put a ban on developing nukes or other weapons of mass destruction. So, and this was recently, the fact that Iran is not seeking a nuclear weapon was recently reaffirmed by the U.S. intelligence agencies and their annual threat assessment and any kind of report. I know the Pentagon's most recent nuclear posture review said the same thing, that Iran is not trying to build a nuclear bomb. All right, so the next one here, Biden smears pro-Palestinian protesters as anti-Semitic, So on Monday, President Biden smeared protesters at college campuses around the country opposed to the Israeli slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza as anti-Semitic. Biden told reporters, quote, "I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians," end quote. Whatever that means. So Biden's comments came. So there's all this media focus. I haven't really been getting into this too much. But there's been all these protests at college campuses across the country against this horrific slaughter that's happening in Gaza. And the big thing, all the media attention right now is on Columbia University in New York City. Students have set up like an encampment there named the Gaza Solidarity Encampment. And last week, some of the students were arrested. The university called in the NYPD and arrested some of them, and some of them were suspended by the university. And then on Monday, there was a big walkout by faculty members. But if you see, you know, the way this goes is that you'll see like all these people make claims that like Jewish students aren't safe at these universities. And you'll see a video. The one video I saw apparently was someone yelling that, you know, October 7th is going to happen again and again and again. And, you know, there's nothing you could do about it. And then that video goes viral. And there's no evidence at all that person represents this protest movement, you know, by any means. But this is what gets picked up and kind of spread. So it's become this narrative that these are anti-Jewish protests, anti-Semitic protests. That's what Mayor Eric Adams said, the mayor of New York City. So this is the narrative. But if you look at what the protesters are really calling for and the groups involved with them, the demand for these protesters is for Columbia University to divest from companies profiting from the Israeli slaughter of Palestinians and the occupation of the West Bank. Al Jazeera reported that the protest is being organized by the student-led coalition Columbia University Apartheid Divest and Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. You know, if you know anything about pro-Palestinian groups, especially college groups, especially in New York, from my own personal experience of living in New York and being involved with some pro-Palestinian groups, there's always a lot of Jews in those groups. There's a lot of Jewish people involved in this activism. So this idea that these are anti-Jewish protests, you know, I bet a large number of Jewish students are taking part in the protests. And I know I've seen some on Twitter say that. So this is the narrative, though. Now we have members of Congress calling for the National Guard to be sent in. I saw Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley say that. So that's what they're calling for. And they're not just talking about Columbia. They're talking about these other universities. I saw Peter Beinart, he's now the editor at large of Jewish Currents. He also made the point in a post on X that Jews are, the way he put it, usually overrepresented among pro-Palestinian protesters at colleges. He said, quote, "Sometimes they're the largest identity group, maybe folks calling for cracking down on protesters in the name of Jewish safety should consider their safety too," end quote. But this is it. This is like, it's kind of hysterical media coverage that you see. And of course, all this stuff on Twitter just being spread around. So while this is going on, while the American media seems to be all focused on this, more bodies have been discovered in that mass grave in Gaza, nearly 300 at this point. This article is from CNN. It says a mass grave with nearly 300 bodies has been uncovered at a hospital in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's civil defense worker said on Monday, following the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the area earlier this month. So I covered this yesterday. At that point, it was nearly 200. Now it's the total number is 283. And they're saying that some of the bodies have been found with hands and feet tied. And so this is the director of Gaza's civil defense who's saying this. He said, quote, "And there were signs of field executions. We do not know if they were buried alive or executed. Most of the bodies are decomposed," end quote. And I know they've said that there are women and children included in this mass grave that they found. So just really horrific stuff. And again, this is in southern Gaza. There was something similar at the El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. And I always think of that there was that video that came out of the two Palestinians on the beach, walking down the beach and getting killed by Israeli forces. And then you see the bulldozer come out and just bury them right away. So you wonder how many times has that happened? Have they just covered up the killing by doing that? All right, so the next one here, Israel has not provided any evidence of UNRWA staff link to Hamas. So this article is from Middle East Eye, and it says, Israeli authorities have not provided any supporting evidence to back up allegations that United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees employees are members of groups that attacked Israel on October 7th, and this was determined by a review led by the former French foreign minister, Catherine Colonna, and the Colonna report, as it's being called, was commissioned by the UN to take a look at UNRWA's operations and policies in the wake of Israel's allegations, and it was released on Monday. It said that Israeli authorities have not responded to letters from UNRWA that were requesting names and evidence in order to open an investigation. So if you remember UNRWA's response to Israel's allegations, they suspended the people that they named right away and said that they were going to launch an investigation. They're trying to conduct an investigation, and Israel's not giving them any information. So as a result of the allegations, UNRWA terminated the contracts of 10 of the employees, and then the other two were confirmed dead. And 16 countries, including the U.S., paused or froze their financial contributions to the agency, amounting to around 50% of the agency's budget for the year. And the point I always make with this is you see the U.S. response to these allegations made by Israel that were made with no evidence. They immediately pause the funding, cut off the funding. And then when there's all this clear evidence of Israel committing mass atrocities in Gaza, you know, the military aid continues to flow. And this lines up with what we've been seeing from countries that tried to look into this, these allegations, is that there's not any real evidence that Israel's providing to make this claim. All right, so the next one here, bakeries finally reopen in North Gaza as Palestinians fight famine. So this article is from Mondo Weiss. And, you know, kind of good news here that Palestinians are able to get bread and things that they weren't able to get before in northern Gaza. You see the picture here is a boy smiling with a bag full of bread. So I'll just read a little bit of it, but this is from one of their correspondents, I believe, who's in Gaza. Lines of thousands of Palestinians with pale faces covered with sweat and smoke, lean and hungry bodies standing in a long line for hours, almost the entire day from morning until night, standing in place. They are all residents and families of the northern Gaza Strip. Are happy today despite their exhaustion and hunger, which has continued for 6 months. This is a day of satisfaction as bakeries finally operated again this past week for the first time since the beginning of October. They were able to distribute bread to people who had been living through a famine during which they lost their loved ones and children. Ahmad Abdel Rahman, 34, a father of five children, has been standing in line for 4 hours along with thousands who went to buy bread today. And this was published on Monday. This is the first day that this bakery has opened its doors in 7 months of war. So this Abdul Rahman said, quote, I will not leave this place until I return to my family carrying bread fit for human consumption. We live through difficult times, eating from the grass of the earth and making bread from animal feed. We hope to not eat this anymore, and we hope to eat bread today, end quote. So bakeries have closed their doors since the beginning of the war due to a shortage of flour, gas, and manpower. Israel also destroyed a large number of bakeries in Gaza as the occupation deliberately created famine to force Palestinians to leave North Gaza. And the remaining bakeries are reopening their doors after humanitarian aid has finally entered northern Gaza. The authorities in North Gaza have distributed it to the bakeries and the population to facilitate production and ease the burden of suffering during this famine. So that means flour is getting there, which is good. Several mainstays are still missing in the north of the Gaza Strip, especially at affordable prices. Many vegetables, fruits, and flour are now slowly available, but not everything people will need. So, of course, you know, here's a picture of a bakery that was destroyed. But of course, you know, they need real relief here. They need an end to the siege and the bombing campaign. But this is at least they're getting some more food, you know. All right, so the next one here, Israeli military intel chief resigns over October 7th. So the head of Israel's military intelligence, Major General Aharon Haliva, announced his resignation on Monday, citing his failure to prevent the October 7th Hamas attack on southern Israel. So he said in a resignation letter, quote, "We did not live up to our mission. I bear full responsibility for the failure. The intelligence division did not live up to the task we were entrusted with. Throughout my duties, I knew that alongside authority comes heavy responsibility," end quote. So this is the first high-ranking military official to resign, and he also called for the establishment of an investigative committee to investigate the attack and the things that have led up to it. So according to an analysis from Haaretz, more Israeli officials are expected to resign after this. And Haaretz, in this analysis, also criticized Netanyahu for not taking responsibility for allowing the Hamas attack to happen. The report said, quote, "It is impossible to ignore the fact that there remains one person that even now refuses to accept any responsibility for the disaster under his watch and to a large degree due to his policies, namely Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu," end quote. So Netanyahu has come under criticism from Israeli media for his previous policy of helping prop up Hamas as part of a strategy to separate the Palestinians in Gaza from those in the West Bank. And the purpose of that was to prevent the creation of a Palestinian state. And this is something, you know, I linked to this article from the Times of Israel here that says this was published on October 8th. "For years, Netanyahu propped up Hamas. Now it blows up in his face." And this again, this isn't some fringe outlet talking about a conspiracy theory. This is mainstream Israeli media. The Netanyahu government and his intelligence agencies and the military also ignored, you know, a mountain of intelligence and warning signs that indicated Hamas was planning something big. And of course, Gaza is one of the most heavily surveilled places on earth. So there's a lot of, you know, why did this happen? How could they have let this happen? Of course, you know, there's all sorts of theories, you know, you can get into here. But just in general, it's clearly a huge, if anything, a huge intelligence failure, you know, and people haven't really answered for it within the Israeli government, military, and intel agencies. All right, so the next one here, Netanyahu resists U.S. plan to cut off aid to Israeli military unit. This article is from ProPublica. So this is something, there are these reports that the U.S. is planning to ban military aid to a specific military unit within the IDF called the Netzah Yehuda, which is an all-male ultra-Orthodox battalion at the center of several controversies in the West Bank that go back years. So Blinken had this thing on his desk recommending that the U.S. sanction this military unit, which means ban military aid to this specific military unit. I believe it's only about 1,000 people strong, this one unit. And this is going back before October 7th. This is the West Bank. They have been repeatedly accused of shooting and assaulting civilians, including in a 2022 case in which several commanders handcuffed, gagged, and left for dead an elderly Palestinian American man in Israel's West Bank. So they killed an American. And so there's these reports saying that the U.S. was going to announce these sanctions, that Blinken was going to announce it. And they were saying it was supposed to happen on Monday, and it hasn't happened yet. But Netanyahu and other Israeli officials are saying this can't happen. There's no way that they could let this happen. So Netanyahu wrote on X, quote, "Sanctions must not be imposed on the Israeli Defense Forces. The intention to impose a sanction on a unit in the IDF is the height of absurdity and a moral low," end quote. I mean, so I don't think the U.S. really has any kind of mechanism to stop aid going to one specific military unit. So we'll see even if they do this now. You know, it was expected on Monday that the U.S. released their big human rights report, which, you know, I'm sure everybody takes that so seriously after they've been supporting this genocidal war in Gaza. But apparently Blinken had this recommendation on his desk from a special State Department panel recommending that he disqualify multiple Israeli military and police units from receiving U.S. assistance. After reviewing allegations that they had committed flagrant violations, including extrajudicial killings and rape. And Blinken has not taken action. They said he was going to do something Monday. Didn't happen. So we'll see if it does happen. All right, so that is it for the news for today. Please go check out our viewpoints. One from Ron Paul, April 20th, 2024, the final nail in America's coffin, and that's the day that the House passed all those horrible, horrible bills, and Biden also signed into law the FISA extension. One from Ted Galen Carpenter, yet another drug war failure. One from Chaz Freeman Jr., what can we learn from our forever war in Ukraine? One from James W. Carden, leading Armenia down the primrose path about Armenia's shift to the West. And our spotlight is from Daniel Larrison, world leaders misdiagnose the U.S. with a crisis of confidence. So that's it for me. Again, please help us with our fundraiser, antiwar.com/donate. If you can't do that, you could always support us by telling your friends about antiwar.com, share this show, like, subscribe, comment. Follow us on social media. All that stuff really helps out. I'll be back tomorrow with some more news. Thanks for listening.